Welcome, reanimated fans, to this week's episode, coming to you from Brooklyn's pandemic zone. Not really. I'm H.A. Conrad, and on the other side of the continent is Stuart Tiffin, my intrepid co-host. Hello, Stuart.
Hey, hey, ho-ho.
In reality, my neighborhood apparently has some of the lowest, my zip code has some of the lowest numbers in terms of COVID diagnoses, or officially reported ones
here.
Anyway. It's still, I mean, look, numbers have come down a lot. That's what the news of the week is here. They are going up in other parts of the country, especially in Texas, and, you know, some other choice bits of the world that are opening up and people are sick of staying home. I've seen a lot of weird behavior yesterday. As I said, the majority of people are masked and trying to be aware and respectful and keeping everybody safe. But there are some outliers. Yesterday, and I have come across this young gentleman on some of my walks of my own. He is running around carrying an American flag and trying to run up to people with masks, asking them if it bothers them that he's not wearing one. And so that's fun.
Seems unnecessary. I mean,
it does. And I ran into him a couple of days ago. But no, this guy is very special, and there's been a couple of them, and it's interesting because if I'm out with my husband, obviously that doesn't happen, but because I was out on my own, like, this guy was like, okay, I'm gonna, like, try to get into your space and be a jerk, and the thing he said to me was, does it bother you that I'm not wearing a mask because it's my right not to? And I've seen some of that kind of attitude played out in the news, I definitely understand, especially, like, there are tons of people out of work, there are tons of people that this is gonna be a deal breaker in terms of, like there's a lot of really horrible things going on right now because of the shutdown. The food banks in New York, there are lines, for example, at the Barclay Center, which is in, like, a couple of neighborhoods away from us, but there are lines around the block, like, hundreds of people deep because people need food. And so I understand those kinds of feelings about wanting to reopen up, wanting to get back to work, but I don't understand the kind of attitude that's like, I'm not going to wear a mask and I don't care about protecting you. I don't care about protecting anybody. Like, that to me is just sort of like, nobody's people aren't wearing masks because they like to, because it's quite honestly really uncomfortable and hard to breathe through them. But it's just something that I feel like people should be doing to protect their neighbors. So I don't know. That's just me getting on my soapbox and saying that. And I just, that's an idea I don't understand. So
for now, the top five, USA, then Russia, though, is number two, which I think that is a new development as of this week or last week.
Well, I mean, I think it's a new development in that it's public. I think that's
the
probably
numbers are out there. But yeah, they're second at 281,000 cases. Then UK, then Brazil, then Spain. And it's sad that Spain, I mean, it's not sad. It's unfortunate that Spain, or maybe it's good that they're still in the top five because they were the top one, top two for a while early on. And then of those, UK has a really disturbingly high death rate, and I don't understand it. The NHS, I think, is just getting slammed. So their death rate is 14.4%, just below Belgium and France. With Belgium, for some reason, has a 16% death rate, and that to me is horrible.
Yeah, I mean, and UK is opening up too. Not Scotland though, and not Ireland. And they basically are like, all right, UK, all right, you guys, you go do what you do, but we're not doing the same thing. And yeah, look, London's a pretty dense population. You also have a lot of people in the category that basically, unfortunately, like the level, like the number of people that have asthma, diabetes, and all the things, unfortunately, that contribute to being vulnerable to this, are there. So I think that is part of it. I also think that from what it sounds like, a lot of the people in the UK have been ignoring the stay-at-home rules. So I think this is totally subjective, based upon some things that friends of mine have been talking about. So that may be a piece of it too. But no, I mean, I'm glad Spain is actually lower on the list. But it's, yeah, it's a very, this is all just very difficult. My husband and I were walking around the other day, and, you know, you're walking around the street, and there's, like, these moments in time when you're just kind of like, is this our reality right now? We're walking around with masks. Everybody's wearing masks, you know? Yeah. It's kind of strange. And, you know, at least for the time being, my work has basically said, hey, we're not going to go back for a while until we know it's safe. And that means, I mean, they're basically prepping people to work through September.
Baltimore Sun had a good article last week, 2 weeks ago now, of the race among white-collar companies to be the last to go back to the office. With some yep. companies, and I forget which ones specifically, are saying, we're Google, not going back to work until 2021, everybody.
Google, Facebook, all those are basically saying that. Yep.
And it makes sense because this paradigm is going to be shifted, and I think it's going to be a good thing, but there is a double-edged sword of once people start working remotely, you do lose some of that culture that, especially Silicon Valley, has been so... put a lot of effort into maintaining a workplace culture. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's become toxic, as we've seen with some companies. But once that kind of gets diluted by more people working remotely, you're going to have, this is what the Sun article went into, like a more tenuous retention, probably management issues and things along those lines. But I think that it's going to be good. I mean, my boss was saying he wants to do Zoom meetings every day going forward. And this is a guy that it was impossible to get a meeting with every week if we were lucky. So honestly, the access is good. And he's also like, I never want to go back to the office.
On my end of things, things are different, and it is, I think it takes more time to do specific things, but once the ball's rolling, I have a lot of uninterrupted time to be able to plan and to put things in place, where, you know, it wasn't quite as easy to take that specific, those specific blocks of time and be able to get things done, basically, because I just would have a lot of people stopping by my office. However, a lot of my job is also connecting with some of the attorneys and doing professional development with them and making sure people are okay. And it's a little harder to do that remotely. Mm-hmm. We're doing it, but it's not, it's just not quite, it's harder to get a sense of how people are doing when they're, you know, and I don't know what, if you've seen this with some of the, your colleagues, some people that you've been working with, but a lot of my people are really zoomed out. So they are much preferring having a call with you versus, or chatting over Skype or whatever it is. You know, they are much preferring to do that than to do a Zoom, and they're trying to avoid it at all costs. So it's kind of interesting. I think it definitely goes through peaks and valleys depending on how people are feeling. And I think especially here in New York, there's been a lot of peaks and valleys in terms of people's mental state. Because I think you go through stages. I'm one of those people that has been feeling that way. And I will admit, when we were having the discussion about, oh, you know, it's going to be maybe till September and then maybe even longer than that because of the schools and stuff like that, I admit my heart sank a little bit because not necessarily that you can't, there aren't positive things about working remotely, and I think that there's going to be a lot more flexibility about that going forward. But just the idea of being in lockdown like this is—it's hard, it's daunting. So there is that piece. The other thing is, I don't know if you saw the article, but there's been a few of them written. Is that because of this shift, and because companies have now discovered that, for the most part, a lot of people can work productively remotely, the access is there, and that kind of thing. New York real estate and the sort of like just the culture of the New York corporate culture may shift dramatically, especially because if people don't have to pay for these massive footprints of these like buildings in New York, these corporate buildings, that is going to change a lot of things. Because if, you know, for example, the place I work in Midtown, that whole area is pretty much dead on weekends. All of the economy of that area, like the restaurants, the stores, like all of that stuff is dependent upon the corporate masses coming in and out every day. Mm-hmm. So that, I mean, people are predicting that that will change.
I hope it, I mean, to an extent, you hope it does. You don't want those kinds of islands of activity The loop no, in Chicago is the same way. I mean, it's dead on set, but that's what allows them to shoot movies down there on the weekends.
Right, right. So, I mean, look, I think that it's, I don't know how, if it's going to be as dramatic as they're saying, because I do think, and I think, look, my company agrees that there are very positive things about being in person and brainstorming and the connections that you're making with people. And honestly, creating that culture, part of why I'm at the place I'm at is because they have a phenomenal culture. We actually like each other. And that is a rare thing to say in any workplace. So I think that it won't be quite as, hopefully not as quite as dramatic as they're saying, but I think there will be a lot of shifts and a lot of changing ideas about what work means, and we'll have to see how that all shakes out. That said, I also think that people are desperate to get out of their houses, so I think for a while, once it's safe to do so, I think people are going to be just like totally like running to New York, running to Manhattan. I haven't been in Manhattan since March 12th, which is crazy.
Well, no reason to go.
So that's kind of interesting, but anyway, so enough about that. Want to get into our actual zombie news stories, and then we're going to do a review of, Ever After or Endzeit, which was, we've talked about it a few times. It's a German film from 2018. So I'm looking forward to chatting with you about that. Actually, before we, do you want to talk about the Blood Quantum article you found? Because I thought that we should talk about that.
We can. I haven't read it in a week now, but I read this interview. I think it was the headline. It was from Vulture, and the headline was Jeff Barnaby is worried that white people aren't going to get Blood Quantum. And then I read it, and I was like, wow, I resemble these remarks. This is not good.
It's not good, and I really those remarks hit home, and I honestly wish we had read the article, or I wish we had come across it before we watched the film.
I would make the counterpoint that I don't necessarily, well, if what he's, I mean, he's the one with the experience, and he's like, yes, so Lysol is completely justified. It was basically the crux of this argument, that white people aren't going to get why Lysol was as bad as he was. And yet, in his circle, like his wife is like, Lysol's clearly the hero of this movie. He's basically saying, because of the experience he's had as an indigenous person, discrimination and the constant onslaught of like being dealt a shitty hand in life, that's why he is willing to burn everything down. And I guess I don't 100% think that it's ever really okay to be a homicidal maniac, I guess, is where I
don't. I thought what some of what he was trying to say is that white people, i.e. us, don't have the sort of, we don't have as much connection with the struggles that indigenous people are still dealing with every day, and that a lot of the discrimination, because it doesn't affect us. So I thought what Jeff Barnaby was actually trying to say in this is that we just don't see and we don't have that connection, so that the character of Lysol and some of the things that he's talking about are obvious to people, to Native American indigenous people, because this is their reality and this is what they've been suffering for years and years and years, and that he is a specific sort of archetype that you're seeing in the Native American community, that his anger and all that stuff make a lot more sense to people.
I got his anger. I completely understood that.
Yeah, me too.
But I'm saying, I don't make the line between anger at the treatment and the hand dealt to indigenous people and being a homicidal maniac. Because there's a bit of a direct line drawn in the interview between those two things.
Right. Well, I mean, I thought he was saying that, like, there is that self-destructive behavior, that because of all of this, you have people that are self-destructive and not in keeping with what the traditions are. And so that's where I was kind of, like, drawing that. But anyway, I just thought it was an interesting article. Maybe we should throw it in there. I went back and I watched parts. I still think that, and look, it's not his job to educate, and to sort of like lay that all out necessarily.
But when there's that, like, much context that you're assuming people,
but if you're get, but if you're trying to put that out and to put that context there,
you gotta understand your audience, you know. And right. So if he was worried about that, that should have been something that he could have addressed to a greater degree in the film. I'm not gonna take all the blame for being a dumb whitey.
Yeah, I'll take a part of it though. I'll take a part of it. Anyway, on to the next news article. So I saw this. It's not just, their Carnival Cruise Lines is reporting that their bookings have increased by like an insane amount. And
600%.
But this is a little misleading because this is also from,
it's up 200% over the same time last year is the thing. So it's not right. That it's just like, yes, they turned on the booking engine and suddenly they had bookings, like, duh. It's the fact that it's actually more people are signing up for cruises in May of 2020 than were in May of 2019.
Yeah, I just don't understand this at all because, and it's not just them, it's like Norwegian and all these other cruise lines. And like, I mean, look, I will be totally flat out, like, cruises never seemed like a good idea to me, even before this all happened. And this part of why they'd never seemed like a good idea to me is that they do a lot of really horrible things, especially with their employees. So because they are not, they're considered like international companies or it's international waters, they do a lot of like dumping, they basically pay all of their employees horrible amounts of money, and a lot of them can't afford to work anywhere else. And like, overall, I find them to be not exactly the most admirable companies. But aside from that, the idea of being on a boat, locked up with people, and the sanitary issues, just like the whole norovirus issue that happens on a lot of these things, this is just never something that appealed to me. I would much rather go out someplace hiking, or, you know, go, if I was going to need some like sand and sun, I'd much prefer going to a resort versus this kind of an experience. But, you know, as we've seen from the whole pandemic, a lot of the cruise ships, that's been a bad place to be when all this has happened. It spreads.
It's certainly like the canary in the coal mine for the coronavirus.
Yeah. Even so, I don't know what's happened recently, but I know in a couple, like in Europe, there was like two or three cruise ships that couldn't basically dock because the countries weren't allowing them to.
I feel like the last one only made it to land a couple weeks ago. And
yeah, those people had been out at sea for like months. Like, oh my God. So you could not pay me enough money to get on one of these things right now.
This is a weird-ass story.
This is very strange.
The next one, though, I want to highlight this one because I, for many years, was a big fan of Anne Rice novels. I read, I haven't read all the Mayfair Witches ones, but I've read a lot of them, a lot of the novels. And I kind of got turned off by it once the movie adaptations started getting made because I felt like they weren't doing them justice.
Right.
But so the big news is AMC has picked up the rights to make a series on the Vampire Chronicles, which is all the Lestat stuff, and then the Lives of the Mayfair Witches, which is the, I forget the guy's name, but they're the ghosts and the witches, the ones from New Orleans.
The Taltos and all that stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
So I also was a huge fan of Anne Rice. I feel like I first started reading her stuff when I was like junior high, maybe. And I will say that I thought the Vampire Chronicles, the first two were okay. And then I think still the first one is probably the best one. And then it totally goes off the rails. Like, there are many, many more books than probably even you are aware of. And it just was it got pretty bad. And then the Mayfair Witches, the first one, the name of the book is escaping me. And again, the first book was great. And I was like, oh, right, I'm going to dive into this other stuff. And then it was like, it got really bad. So, I will say she has a gift for creating different like New Orleans. Obviously, she lived down there. San Francisco, she lived there. And she, like, one of the things that I think is so funny, like, and she does this in like a few of the books, is that she really hates French accents for some reason. She's like, they're harsh and ugly. And she does this in like several of her books. But obviously, she draws from her experience to create these beautiful, like, set pieces basically for her characters. And the Vampire Chronicles was like, she created like her own mythology in a really cool way and a different way, and that was great.
Yeah. The Witching Hour, or the Witching Hour, is the first novel.
It is
the Mayfair ones have also a very, very not compelling, but a very well thought out background and mythology. Right. Also, there is some weird stuff with like ghost dildos that I think is gonna. I'm not sure how AMC is gonna handle those scenes. So, yeah. Because really it's only something you can read. And even then you feel a little bit embarrassed, but,
The guy's named Lasher.
Lasher is the second novel too, but yeah, that's like the name of the main ghost, I think. Mm-hmm. Anyway, let's see. This is going to be very, very interesting to see how AMC puts them together. I wonder if Nicotero is going to work on them.
Yeah, maybe. So we'll see how that goes, but that could be cool. And then we saw, like, both of us saw this thing, but this is, I jumped ahead of, but this was the, it was basically a review of, there was a comic book that came out, which is based upon Kingdom.
Kingdom was based on the graphic novel, but then this is somehow based on Kingdom. So it's kind of like it's gone full circle.
But anyway, I mean, the artwork is beautiful. But apparently it's pretty hollow in terms of the storyline, and they kind of are reaching pretty far. And actually, you know, generally when I see things like this where they do try to do a graphic novel after a movie or whatever, that's usually the case.
What's odd here, too, is part of the plot is there's some people trying to get a prince returned to the throne, and it's not Li Chang. It's a different guy.
Huh.
Like, how many dethroned princes are there in Joseon? Probably a lot, but still.
So I guess there's a few. King got around. But it is beautiful artwork. So I enjoyed, like, kind of seeing a few of those panels. And then you and I both saw this, but it's the Legends of Tomorrow promo, which is actually kind of funny.
I've seen exactly 1.5 episodes of Legends of Tomorrow.
I've seen none of them, and this reminded me that I should try to watch it.
You liked John Constantine, right? The show with the British guy, not the one with Keanu Reeves.
I like Constantine. And I like Hellblazer. But I haven't liked any adaptation they've done that anybody has done with his character. I thought the show was a little, there were some okay things about it, but I don't think anybody's done that character justice, quite frankly. Anyhow.
I occasionally watch the show that the actor has now reprising that role on Legends of Tomorrow, and that's honestly probably the only compelling reason for me to go back to take another look at it. But in this episode, it's just going to, I think, be a one-off unless they do a mini arc, but there are going to be zombies on Legends of Tomorrow, and that's still to coming up. I forget when. Maybe is it this week?
But they do a spoof on I Am Legend, apparently, and they've got a Shaun of the Dead shout out there too. So anyway, I might actually take a look at this, even though it's not something that I've watched, but I might try it. And then in other comic book news, there was a whole article about Zombie Wolverine and how disgusting a Zombie Wolverine would be because of his biology and his metal skeleton. So I just thought that was a funny article. Yeah,
it's mostly looking at this one panel or a series where Zombie Wolverine's going after Silver Surfer, and I guess his arm just kind of like goops out and falls on the floor, and the writer is just like, wow, that's really gross, and wrote a whole article about it. And props to that author, because that's not a whole lot to write an article about. And there's a second there's a second article about Zombie Hulk having bitten off Silver Surfer's head, and Zombie Hulk is a truly terrifying prospect.
Yeah, and I actually don't really believe that Wolverine could become a zombie just because of his, I mean, they try to say, oh, his biology would allow for him to become a zombie, but he's just like healing, so I just don't find that to be plausible. But I guess they had to do it because he's such a popular character and divisive character. So, all right, so let's talk about what you were doing Oh. Last night, they kept you up so late.
Yeah, and you're talking about people being burned out on Zoom, but it's also, for a lot of people, the only outlet for any kind of socialization. I've had a few date nights and, you know, social gatherings on Fridays and Saturdays on Zoom now, and it's, yeah, it's not the same as getting together with people, but it's, you know, it's still like a it's like an intense conversation in a way, because you can't wander away or get distracted so much. I mean, you can, but then that's kind of rude to walk away from a Zoom that you're on specifically to talk to some people. But so last night, it was a friend's birthday party, and so her brother-in-law, her husband's brother, is an actor actually in LA, and he was on Big Bang Theory and a few other things. And he has, since all of his gigs have dried up, you know, there's no acting really going on. He started this little business called Play Free Space. And it's basically they host parties on Zoom. They play bingo and they do trivia. And so for this party last night, they had 15 or so people Zoom in. There's three hosts. So they already kind of populate the event a little bit. They're DJing music. And it was just, I didn't know what to expect. And then it was actually a lot of fun. And so I want to support struggling artists, and I feel like this is a, I love stories of people pivoting during this, because, you know, that takes a certain determination and innovation. So if you get a chance, folks, they're on Instagram at Play Free Space, all one word. And if you're looking for something to do and you've got a party but you can't go out, consider throwing these guys your business. It wasn't super expensive. It was like $25 per call-in, whatever. Me and my wife shared a screen. And so that's kind of the long short of it. But I was up, because after that ended at like 10:30, and then I had to watch Endsight. So I was up pretty late.
I will actually check that out. That seems like fun. You're correct in that it's a little bit more intense, because it's like you have to be there in front of the screen. It's not like, you know, if you're gathered around at a restaurant or like at a pub or in a like park or whatever, people can wander off and do their own thing and come back. But you can't really do that with Zoom so much. Let's get into our review. Ever After, Endsight. So we have talked about this a little bit. This was on our list for quite a long time. So I'm glad we finally got around to it. And this, like, it's very interesting because it actually has some themes that definitely play, and these aren't like unusual themes, but themes that we saw in Blood Quantum last week. So that's kind of an interesting thing to talk about. But the director was Carolina Helsgard, which is a fantastic name. And then the screenplay was by Olivia Viewig. You know, let's the sort of general plot of this, and you get sort of the gist of this is ahead of the film. Like, there's a whole like, this is giving you this sort of lowdown, is that basically the apocalypse has happened. This is in Germany. There's two cities. One is looking for a cure and one is not, but neither, like, one won't let people live if they've been infected. So you're talking about Weimar and Jena. Is that correct in pronouncing
Jena? Jena. Weimar, okay. Or Weimar, but we can just call Weimar. I think.
Cool. And we immediately start with one of the main characters, and this is Vivi. And, you know, I will say that overall, this is a beautiful movie. There's
the cinematography is probably the best thing about it.
It's so gorgeous. It makes me want to wander around Germany, honestly. And there's just, not like this, but like, I just think there's some really pretty parts of this.
Yeah.
So
they find some great shots, and the resolution. I feel like, I don't know if they did that in post, but whatever camera they're using seems to be able to focus on everything in the picture at once. It was really gorgeous. I thought so too.
And it was very, it's definitely, the whole thing has a fairy tale feel to it, like an unreal feel to it. And I think that plays into some of the storylines and some of the decisions they decided to go with this. So let us hop in.
So the establishing text explains that between Weimar and Jena, Weimar is all about like killing on sight. They don't mess around. They kill the infected, and Jena, they are looking for a cure. And so that kind of sets up the juxtaposition between these two places. But we start in Weimar, and we start on the fence, looking at the bunnies outside. I mean, this movie is full of nature shots, and it's the most hit you over the head theme of the film is nature seems to be doing just fine. These clearly are zombies who mostly don't eat animals, but there is one scene where one of them does eat a bird.
Yeah, nature seems fine, and they kind of hit you over the head with that theme throughout the movie, and that's even part of the mythology here.
Yeah.
And I will say that it wasn't totally clear to me that Vivi was in an institution, though that's what she's in. I just, because, you know, you got to figure when people are during a zombie apocalypse, some are going to be dealing with it better than others. She's medicated. And there's like different kind of weird people wandering around the building she's in. And she definitely has this person that's kind of caretaking her. But it's still, you know, in this kind of a world, it wasn't, for me at least, totally clear that this wasn't just sort of like the way things are and people are walking around the city heavily medicated.
Because you don't see where like Ava lives, for instance, or any of the other people. Vivi is dressed differently than everybody else. Most people are dressed in like utilitarian sort of communist garb, like worker clothes. And she's wearing
definitely
a blouse
not.
And a skirt and flip-flops. Yeah. And you're just like, what? Why? Well, so the woman taking care of her is also later identified as, oh God, is it the warden or something along those lines?
Yeah, it's the warden. And, you know, this is the other thing that they set you up with this main character. And she's definitely a narrator that you don't trust. There's lots of weird stuff that happens throughout this film. And it's very difficult to determine what is real and what is not. What might be in her own head, what is the actual reality of this world. So that's something that they set up pretty quickly. I think even just the way she's dressed, she's definitely not like fitting in with this particular, with everybody else that we're seeing, at least in Weimar. Even when they film her, there's definitely a softness to it. Like the light and everything around her is very dreamlike. And then it gets much harsher when you see other characters like Ava. Or the people on the barricade. It's like a really cool effect. And again, I just thought the cinematography was really well done here in trying to draw those contrasts between the two characters, two main characters.
Right. But we don't know. Yeah. At first, I was convinced that Isabel was going to be her traveling companion because she makes eye contact and she's talking to her. She's a little too into talking to Vivi, honestly.
Oh, no, I thought she was done for from the first thing that she said to her, because she's so positive.
Yeah.
There has to be some conflict for it to be, you know, to have these two characters going along. But yeah, that was like kind of sad and really fast in terms of
it was fast, unexpected. And whoever was on guard duty should have been summarily executed, not just poor Isabel, who doesn't last more than 5 minutes in the movie. Because they have scenes of somebody in a watchtower with a rifle taking shots at zombies in the distance. But this guy, first of all, these are fast zombies. And second of all, this guy made it all the way to the wire and then took a chunk out of Isabel's arm.
I also have to say, Isabel and Vivi, so this whole thing is that they've both volunteered to go and help out at the barricade. And, you know, look, Vivi's definitely out there, and Isabel, they're both new. They're, like, green, and I just don't believe that they would be this sort of, like, I didn't believe that Isabel would be right up on the fence like that, because they're scared, and they've never even seen this, whereas the people who've been working on the barricade every day, this is old hat to them. But these guys are timid and kind of scared, so I don't know that I bought that would have happened, but I guess you wouldn't have had a movie without it. So, but basically, Isabel is messing around with a little bit of the barricade because some of it's come down. Ava has been, she kind of showed them the ropes, but she's very much just like done with everything. She's totally had enough of everything. She makes a nasty comment to Vivi that, you know, they're sending the weaklings now. And like, so I think that they did this in for a few reasons. One, to show how, like, Ava's just kind of done with this whole thing and just tired and doesn't really care about anybody anymore. But also to obviously show what the sort of rules are in this world, which is that if you get bitten, you're done. And not only are you done, but the person who was responsible has to take you out. They do even the whole, you know, so Ava cuts Isabel's arm off to stop the infection from getting to her brain, but they're like, nope, can't risk it, and then they make her shoot her. And it's a really, like, they do, this tells you a lot of things in a very short amount of time.
Mm-hmm. They are a no second chances sort of society. And they also get to see the train to Yaena before this happens. They see a one car, like, train sort of chugging along outside the wire, and they're like, oh, look, that's the train. You'll never get on that train. Just supplies. But then you're like, okay, somebody's getting on that train. And then that does happen very soon, like the next day.
Again, I have some questions about this, because, like, if it's, like, such a thing where people don't get on this train, like, wouldn't it be a little bit more, I don't know,
guarded,
like, careful, guarded, and there's supplies and there's valuable stuff on the train, right? Yeah. And so I can't imagine that these two women are the only people not psyched about the, like, life in Weimar. So, but anyway, this sets them up in two very distinct ways. Ava's, like, the badass. Vivi is almost, like, scared of her own shadow. She's taking a lot of, she's taking medication. She also, cuts herself. So there's that stuff going on.
She's clearly dealing with, is she already having flashbacks at this stage?
She's been having them from the beginning.
Yeah. Yep. And so she's having a really hard time coping. She's clearly got PTSD, like, on another level. And then, yeah, she tries to kill herself. This is for the first time in the film, she tries to kill herself in the bathtub, but then wakes up with the warden right there, and all she says is, they're gonna need you back out on the wall tomorrow, or something worse to that effect. And I think Vivi just can't handle that.
Yeah. You know, it wasn't clear to me that she was actually trying to kill herself. I think there's scars all over her, so she might just be cutting. But either way, it was a pretty deep one, given the blood in the water, but hard to tell. And also, you know, let's just throw this out there, but if Vivi is known for this, because she's got, like, scars all over her arm and everything, do you think they would have left broken glass anywhere near this woman, or glass in general?
Maybe not.
Just saying.
Yeah.
But yeah, so she, and then we see, you know, after this happens, again, this is, like, sometimes it's very hard to tell what is real and what is not in this film, what is in Vivi's head and what is not. Anytime she goes out wandering, there's just, like, a very dreamlike quality. And in this case, when she leaves the weird table that she's on, she's like, oh, I'm going to go sleep near the rail station. Nobody notices her there.
Well, the old man breaks her out of the hospital.
Yeah.
And he's what he had already said to her when they interacted in the halls of the hospital. Like, what are you still doing here? You need to get out of here. But it wasn't clear that he was talking to her, or that he knew her, or that she knew him. But then the next night, after she wakes up, he breaks a glass door, because that's really secure. He breaks a glass door and she runs away.
Well, let's also say he's left to wander into his own devices as well, in a way that probably isn't the safest bet. But even when she's wandering down to the rail area, we see, like, she has these visions, or she thinks that things are behind her, and you see, like, little glimpses of sort of what her reality is. And I thought that was really well done, because you just don't know what to trust in terms of what your perception is of this story, at least from her point of view.
Yeah.
And that really establishes it, I think, for the whole movie, really.
In the central square of Weimar, I don't know who those are. There's a placard on the statue surrounded by, I think it's like a charging station, maybe. I'm not sure exactly what is going on with all those things. But there's a sign that says, please don't hamster, we don't have enough water. And so I Googled, like, what does hamster mean in German? I mean, maybe it's clear to you. It's like you put things in your cheeks. But apparently Hamsterkauf has become, especially during COVID, has become like a catchphrase, because it's like the hoarding, the buying of the toilet paper is Hamsterkauf. And it's when you hamster buy. just love German is such a fun language because they just combine words that sometimes don't make sense or sometimes totally do. And it's like, you know, Schadenfreude or any of these kinds of things. It's German. It can be delightful sometimes. Either way, so please don't hamster. Please don't hamster. We don't have enough water is the sign on the fountain in downtown Weimar.
That is very cool. I saw the sign and I just figured that's what it, I figured it was just like hoarding stuff, but I didn't realize that that was a thing. So that's kind of cool. But they get the story pretty much underway very quickly.
They're rolling out of, I was actually surprised that they were outside of Weimar by the time they're on the train and Eva reveals herself to be on the train too. And of course, Vivi must just be terrified in a state of constant terror, you know?
Yeah.
But so, and that's pretty clear. Like the actor does a good job of portraying that. Eva is clearly never afraid, at least not at this point in the film. And so they're now traveling companions for better or for worse, although they're not really talking to one another or interacting until the train stops. And I was not, I did not realize that they were actually outside of the wire in a way. I thought, well, maybe it's a customs check or I don't know. Were you just like, yep, this is clearly the middle of nowhere? It wasn't clear to me until they said that they were in the middle of nowhere.
Well, it wasn't clear. I mean, this train has been going so long and fine. And I guess I had a lot of questions about how this train keeps running.
I mean, without... they couldn't have just gotten on the train and ended up in Jena and had like a 15 minute movie. But yeah.
Well, no, I mean, my bigger questions about the train is that obviously it is not going to be totally soundless in terms of going on these tracks. So it seems pretty quiet. So I just thought it would attract a lot of the infected, basically. So that was my biggest question about how it was going back and forth sort of unscathed. And they never really explain why it breaks down. It just kind of stops. So I wish there was a little bit of more of an explanation there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you go to Germany and try to do some train travel, you will realize that these trains are problematic.
But if it's like a lifeline between the two cities, I don't know. Anyway, but in any case, that's how they set it up. And then, you know, throughout this film, we see a lot of references to nature taking over, as you had said. We see...
when she's dyeing her hair, there's like a giant spider, but she's like happy to see it. You got a bathroom full of butterflies on the train. You've already had the bunnies. You got pigs. By the time we saw the pigs, I was just like, oh my God, this sledgehammer of nature is already smacking me into unconsciousness. It was a little much.
And this is what, 2 years?
2 years after
all of this happened. So things are progressing quite quickly in terms of the overgrowth.
We've seen this with COVID though. I mean, there are coyotes in my town. There are coyotes everywhere now. There are mountain lions being seen in residential neighborhoods. We saw this. Like there was a town in Wales that got like taken over by wild mountain goats. And that's just within weeks of people stopping driving around. So yeah, I completely get this. And when I lived in Germany, there were fairly regular news stories about like a boar going into a grocery store, not like regularly, but at least one, a boar going or a pack of boar going into a grocery store and tearing it to shreds because they're just very destructive animals.
They are horrible animals.
So I could see this happening.
Yeah, no, I could definitely see it happening, but I think that they're really trying to hit that point home.
For sure.
And, you know, we've got the very different personalities of these two. I mean, I think if she were allowed to, Vivi would just have stayed on this train had she not, you know, made the mistake she did. Ava's constantly
she basically tries to commit suicide a second time on this train by just giving up and saying, well, that's it then. Because she has her first real vision of her of the girl in the red bathing suit and with a pack of zombies that night on the train. And when she yells out loud, she actually draws real zombies because that wasn't real. And Ava's like, you dummy, I'm going to leave you here. But then comes back for her.
Yep. And look, Ava's like constantly looking for a way out. I think that she, despite the fact that she insults Vivi so much, she still doesn't want to be alone. And she knows that she's much more likely to survive if she's got her along with her. I have some questions about that because it doesn't really seem like Vivi does a ton of help in that department.
She fixes the camera. Like that's the use that she presents.
Yep. But you know, you know, one of my criticisms definitely, and this is just, you know, this was a choice of the director, is that I definitely felt like It is a slow burn in terms of the storytelling, and I felt like it could have been a little tighter. There is a lot of scenes of just kind of like, and again, it's beautiful. It's a different stylistic choice in terms of storytelling, and it does show sort of the relationship and the dynamic between these two and the world they're in. And so I think it's intended to be world building. But it just felt to me like huge parts of this film felt very slow. I don't know how you felt about it, but I just felt like some of this could have been edited down.
It was definitely a psychological, more of a psychological thriller than a horror zombie film. But it was taking a lot from The Odyssey and these kinds of, yeah. So they're working more on a metaphorical level than a visceral, I'm going to scare you to death level, which is good. I mean, honestly, it's good that you can have this much variety in our genre, and so I'm grateful for it. It's not like necessarily my first choice of a zombie film, but you know, it still works. So glad that Ava finally finds Vivi some real shoes. Mm-hmm. I was actually thinking her name was Renata at this point in the film, because the flashbacks that she's having of the swimming pool scene are from her sister's perspective for some reason, and you don't really get a clear view of her face. At least I didn't. So I was like, oh, her name's, she goes by Vivi, but her name's Renata, because I was confused.
Oh, okay. I admit I was slightly confused too. I wasn't sure if she was the girl in the pool at first.
Yeah. That's.
And then obviously when she starts having the visions, I'm like, oh, okay. So she's being haunted by her sister or something.
And she's looking at herself in her dream, which I've never had a dream in the third person. So, you know, good for her.
But they do have some like really cool scenes between them. There's the whole, and then again, the whole thing about nature taking over, you start to hear a little bit of the philosophy about this, especially from Ava, which is that humans have just screwed up the planet and now nature is taking over. And she even pretty much flat out says what we see later on, which is that Mother Nature is a bitch and we have outstayed our welcome.
Yeah, we haven't paid rent. I thought that was a really good thesis statement that comes about halfway through the film. The Earth is a wise old lady. Humans haven't paid their rent in a long time, and this is our eviction order. Or what's going on here is our eviction order. I thought that states the whole film, basically.
Yep, pretty much. And but we see some like cool things, like they see giraffes that have escaped from the zoo and are doing just fine out there, and that's like a really cool thing.
They also find a squad of humans who have very recently been killed, although they kind of walk up on this while there's still a zombie eating festival going on. And it doesn't seem, I mean, we didn't hear any gunshots, though apparently there was some sort of mass suicide or something. I thought that this was just a good way to keep linking in the fact that this is still a populated, you know, there are people from Weimar who are coming out to try and find the train, not necessarily Ava or Vivi. But so that is part of this. To get there, we're having these beautiful shots of them walking along train tracks on like a rail bridge in a forest. Still continuing with the beautiful visuals. And one of the things I kept thinking about during this long day of walking after they got off the train is Ava has half a bottle of water when they start.
I know.
They have no food, and they just go all day and into the night without anything. Right. Basically, until they get to that castle the next day and they find the cucumbers, they've traveled on half a bottle of water. And Vivi basically gets one sip.
Because Ava's just, you know, stingy with the water. And then we also, while they are on this little journey, this little walkabout, we also see the next part of like the mythology of this, which is that there's a bride zombie that has basically plants growing out of her, and they both comment on this. And she's behaving in a way they haven't seen. She seems a little bit less dangerous, a little bit more confused, I guess. Though she ultimately does come after them both. But she even has like a bird that's just kind of like hanging out on her shoulder. And they both, you know, this also shows that despite what they've been through, Vivi is still unwilling to kill the walkers, even if they pose a threat. But Ava is just like, this is something you're going to have to do and grow up a little bit. So they have very different ways of coping with this. Ava also throws away the medication that Vivi's been sucking on for this whole time. And we also have visions that Ava's having, which are in black and white and very, they kind of make, they have like the zombie sort of weird music. So I mean, and there's been moments throughout this up to this point where she's been like holding her side.
Yeah.
So
we know that she's infected. She's desperate to get to Yaena. We all know.
Yeah.
We just didn't see it happen, and I'm not sure if it happened at the when Isabel got taken down or prior to that.
I think it probably happened prior to that, because she's just, you know, I think she seems kind of like upset, and I don't know. It feels like it probably happened before that. Like
that's why she's already at the end of her rope when they show up.
Yeah. And why she's so interested in the train. So in any case, they're doing their little walkabout, and when they do end up in the Garden with the Cucumbers, it kind of seems like heaven. I have to say, like, this is a, like, again, like, I just feel from a storytelling point of view, exploring places, like, they found that food. Like, why would you even bother?
Keep going inside, you mean?
Yeah, and, like, there's just a lot of, like, darkness and blind spots, and you're just two people, and one of you is not very effective at killing people.
They were more worried about humans inside the castle than zombies, based on their short discussion of, like, is it worth the risk to go inside? We don't know who's in there or how crazy they are. There was, yep. Like, that was the discussion. It wasn't like, oh, there's probably zombies. Because, I don't know, right. Like, they don't expect to run into zombies most of the time. They kind of, zombies are random.
Kinda weird.
But they're not worried about them in there for some, I don't know, and I don't really understand why. But they seem to be right. Like, there weren't zombies in the castle. There had been people until very recently, or until
right.
some point in the past.
Right, and then this is the part where we start to see Ava show more signs that she's been infected. She kicks the crap out of Vivi after having, like, a kind of crazy fit. And then Vivi kind of gets back at her and pushes her into the moat, basically.
Yeah.
Which is like, whoa. And then rescues her. So there's lots of, like, back and forth between these two. And then finally Ava confesses, like, why she wants to go to Yaena. And, like, there is an understanding between them. And it also establishes that the zombies can swim. Like, there's some in the moat there, so that helps. But Ava, again, has to dispatch this zombie because Vivi is unwilling to do so. So basically, Ava at this point is just like, look, I'm pretty far gone. We better go our own separate ways because I'm, you know, I'm done. And then this gets into the weirder part of the film.
We then jump into Crazy Town. Yeah. So the gardener shows up and saves Vivi in the orchard from the bride, who has once again shown mm-hmm. up and is about to kill her. And then the gardener shows up, and what's a little weird is she saves Vivi's life, and then she walks away saying, I don't want anything to do with humans, but she just intervened in a situation right. where she could have just left Vivi to die.
Well, and her behavior in general is kind of weird because, like, she makes that statement and then later wants Vivi to stay with her. And then this is all kind of like...
And Vivi promises to stay with her, but then doesn't. And I feel like there's no ramifications for that.
Right. But maybe she's promising in a bigger way to stay with her. This is all very weird. And yeah. The gardener looks like, I mean, she's got plants growing out of her head.
Pretty good makeup, honestly.
Yeah, it's very cool. And she's talking about, again, it's the whole philosophy that humans have wasted their time on Earth. They've basically poisoned the Earth. And now it's their time to go back. She makes a lot of statements like, I've created things that have no fear, no greed, no hatred. And that's why this is all happening. And you see these, the Earth is basically taking everything back. And, you know, it's interesting. Like, it's a weird little back and forth between them. Again, at this point, I was like, what is this? Is this like a total hallucination? What is happening? I don't understand it.
Yeah, because as soon as Vivi was by herself, I was like, okay, is she having visions now? Is this really happening? I was in the same place.
Yeah.
But then Ava, turns out, is like half buried in the backyard. And yep. And the gardener, if it is a figment of her imagination, is able to feeds her a tomato and says, I'll give her an extension. And then Ava comes yep. back. It's like, what?
Yeah. And she's all like, you know, that she's definitely we see like the infection is progressing for her.
We've also had another suicide attempt by Vivi because she found a gun
right.
in a pile of tarps or something and tried to shoot herself just before the gardener was like, oh, oh, if you're cool with that, then hang out with me for a while and I'll show you some plants and some pictures that I drew.
Yep. Yep. And this is like the whole philosophy, the film that they go into here. And then also once Vivi and Ava are united, we have some confessions from both of them explaining a little bit more about why their mindsets are what they are in this. And Ava basically says she's haunted by every single person that she's killed during the apocalypse. Vivi confesses about, you know, her sister and that she left her to die. And we see a lot more of that.
Those flashbacks are heartbreaking between her and her sister.
They're pretty bad. They're pretty horrible. And basically her sister was in the pool and she had to leave her there because her sister wouldn't get out.
And Ava's flashback is bad, but I mean, she technically locks a bunch of living people out of the building she runs into. But within mm-hmm. seconds of doing that, there's blood on the window and people are getting eaten.
Right.
So I feel like she didn't really have a choice.
Right. And also, I mean, these aren't, at least it's not clear to me. I don't know how well she actually knew these people.
They're just people like in the plaza, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's that. And so the two of them continue their journey after this confession, going to Yaina again through really beautiful land. And it doesn't last very long. Although I want to say that the shot that happens when the end of Ava happens is pretty amazing. They're like kind of walking across this dam bridge and like the overhead shot is pretty cool. And basically Ava warns Vivi that they're coming. There's a lot of them coming. And
there really are a lot of them coming.
Yeah. And she's noticed that like her arm is starting to turn, like there's things growing like weeds on her arm. And so she's like, okay, I'm going to let Vivi go and sacrifices herself.
It's a little weird because they've just been reunited in the scene before. Then Ava sacrifices herself, goes down. It's a fairly bloodless zombie takedown. You just see them all over her, but she sinks into them. So it's a little weird and probably more metaphor than anything. And then Vivi just kind of continues on, sits under a tree. Very beautiful shot of her sitting under a big tree after losing her friend. Yep. I mean, I guess that kind of goes without saying. Every shot in this
is beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. And she ends up, like, I guess she's looking for food in this other house. Again, I have lots of questions. I think...
The juice, whatever she's drinking, there's, like, mold, clearly mold.
Yeah, I'm like, what are you doing?
Well, I think part of this is, the transformation she goes through in this house... This reminds me of a psych class I took in college. What she's drinking is like an entheogenic potion that is like priming her for her journey. And then when the blind zombie pokes her eye out with an antler, that's her like passing over a part of her body into the afterworld. And she becomes like her own spirit guide. Oh, yeah, I took this class.
Well, I think also the whole house itself is like there's so much symbolism within the house. Like she goes in, there's like a lot of animals and birds that have been like there's antlers on the wall. There's lots of taxidermy stuff happening here. And without question, judgment about how horrible humans are with their excess and their greed. Pretty much every single thing that the gardener had accused humans of is evident within this house or the aftermath of this house. And you know, there's like weird feasts set up and things like that. And so she definitely goes through like a sea change spirit journey in this house. And the I actually read, I guess it's like a similar thing, but I read her drinking the thing like Alice in Wonderland, which is, you know,
well, same thing. Yeah.
Similar idea.
Drink this magic tonic that will somehow help you or at least change your mindset. But then losing the eye and her Hercules moment where she's like, oh, you're going to poke my eye out with some antlers. I'm going to go all ragey on you. And she kills her first zombie there.
Yep. A blind zombie, because we know this because there's Braille. And his dog is apparently really well kept and groomed. Beautiful. Doesn't want to come with her after all this, but you know, she
I was a little surprised that the dog didn't, because she's like, do you want to come with me? And the dog just looks at her, but then the next scene I was like, oh, where's the puppy? He's not. That's sad.
I thought the same thing. It seemed like a weird addition to even put in there, but again, maybe it's just that she's got to make the journey on her own. She doesn't get any help. Yeah. And then she ends up outside the gate at Yaina. And
she crosses this. She comes to a river and crosses a river. Yet another piece of imagery.
I forgot the key part.
She crosses the river Styx or whatever it is. Because on the other side, she sees a red bathing suit and she finds her sister's body. And and this very sweet moment, and I wonder how this actor managed this, because she's lying down next to like a fake corpse and having a very cute and touching moment with the body that appears to be that of her dead sister, or the zombie of her dead sister, like the zombie had died by the riverside. She talks to it like, oh, I heard your voice, you know, back in Weimar. Were you just trying to call me out to see you one last time, et cetera, et cetera. You got here all this way by yourself. It's a very cute moment. But then she like goes to sleep and gets covered in moss overnight, or longer time than overnight. What are we thinking?
It's hard to say. Again, I don't think that time has a linear. Is linear here. But basically she is. I think that this just shows that she's very much in tune. There's a reason why the gardener had wanted her to stay. You know, a few different people had made comments, like the crazy guy that breaks her out, that all the weeds are going to grow in her veins. She wakes up and she's got like plants growing out of her eyes and out of her wrist, which, you know, and she takes them out, but then and covers her sister with her shirt. And so she's all like, you know, kind of a shed. I read that very much as shedding like her innocence and shedding sort of the world that she had been in to become something else. And she just evolving basically. Mm-hmm. So I and left her sister to rest, which had been the thing that had been torturing her for so long. And then she ends up in Jena
or outside of
Jena. And suddenly Ava makes an appearance, and she looks an awful lot like the gardener. She's got stuff growing out of her wounds. And basically Vivi is like, yep, they're not going to like that you're here. And they just kind of walk off and literally into the sunset with each other a new world. And then the voiceover, you know, we've heard a lot of throughout the film, which turned out to be her little sister's mantra about her gods and things that she would say to herself to stay, to be not afraid of the dark. And Vivi has taken that and continued that. And basically, that's kind of what she's become. And she's no longer scared. And she's become all the things that the gardener had basically predicted in their meeting. And so it's basically like they're not, and it there's like a total switch. Like, all along, you were thinking of Jena as this place that was the goal to get to, that it's a place where good people are and, you know, they're looking for a cure and whatever. And this just turns it on its head because Vivi is basically viewing them as poison, which is what the gardener had said in the first place. So it's like an interesting end to the movie, which just sets everything out on its head. And you're accepting the zombies and the infected as the cure versus the evil, which is, it's a totally weird mind.
Super optimistic approach. So that's, it's like I said, very psychological. Definitely took that class in college. Also, the walk from Jena from Weimar to Jena should only take 4.5 hours. It takes them 4.5 days, I think. It's like 14 miles. It's really not very far.
Apparently the writer, that was like the two towns she had to commute between, which is why I think that was decided upon. That was in the trivia on the Amazon Prime Video.
Okay.
But I, you know, I overall, I think that this was worth watching. As I said, slow burn, psychological, but really, truly beautiful. I just wish that there had been a little bit more editing. That's all.
Yeah, I enjoyed it, you know, despite the fact that I was watching it in the middle of the night and a few vodkas in. I thought that it was definitely enjoyable. At the time, I think I thought it was a little heavy-handed with the thematic material, but in retrospect, like reflecting on it, it's actually pretty strong, and I enjoyed it. So
yeah, me too.
That's where I'm at. Next, are we ready to wrap this thing up? Should we talk about what we're going to do next?
Let's do it.
Next time we are going to be reviewing or recapping a film known as The End?
Question mark?
Not to be confused with Endsight or Ever After, which is what we just talked about. The End comes to us as a recommendation from listener Kevin. Thank you for that recommendation. Italian film from 2017. I forget the Italian name and I can't pronounce it. I think it was Inferno Fuori. Anyway, we're going to be talking about that film next time on Reanimated, and you can let us know what you think about Endsight or Ever After. If you think it was too heavy-handed, if you think it was an exciting romp through the Black Forest, You can let us know on Twitter at reanimatedpcast. Our email is at reanimatedpodcast@gmail.com. Our show notes are online at reanimatedpodcast.com.
Yeah, and thanks for listening. And also, anybody else has recommendations of things that they liked or that we should definitely watch, please send them our way. And so until next time, stay safe out there, everybody, and ciao.
Thank you. Bye-bye.